news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be in the pocket with you guys, getting into gear and going in pursuit of the enigmatic. Lots happening in the world right now. A lot to report on, including a few things I've been involved with in recent days. Also, good news, NASA says no threat, at least presently, from a huge asteroid that was recently in our planetary neighborhood. Also, the discovery of unique things on the International Space Station. Where did they come from? And why has that got scientists talking? We'll delve into all of that and more a bit later. But, you know, recently I have been doing a lot of research into aviation incidents involving purported UAP. That's right. In fact, NASA's ongoing collection of pilot reports involving UAP led to an investigation by yours truly and the debrief team. And that was helped along by a gentleman named Ted Rowe, who will be our guest this week. He is one of the co-founders of the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. And in my opinion, someone who is uniquely positioned to be able to provide commentary on not only the UAP issue more broadly, but with specific relevance to what it means for aviators and why, in truth, awareness of the UAP issue in the aviation community might actually help move the dialogue forward on UFOs in sum total. Which really makes sense if you think about it, because again, UFOs tend to operate in the sky. Pilots do often report encounters. And although the FAA does not collect those, and in fact, at the FAA website, you can visit its page for UFO reporting, and it will tell you, civilian agencies like the National UFO Reporting Center, run by Peter Davenport, that it recommends that you contact instead. The FAA will also tell you sometimes to contact local law enforcement. In other words, they don't want very much to do with UFOs. But that does not mean that pilot reports involving near mid-air collisions and other potential hazards to aviation aren't nonetheless reported to the FAA, although the FAA doesn't actually collect those reports and analyze them. No, it outsources that job to, you guessed it, NASA. And so we're going to be talking with Ted Rowe, director of research and also co-founder there at NARCAP, because he, over the years, has not only analyzed some of these pilot incidents involving UAP or UFO encounters, but Ted told me, as he will discuss with us later in the program here, that he and his organization actually cooperated with the Aviation Safety Reporting System maintained by NASA, the very database which has been collecting UFO reports over the years. So, all of that and more awaits. Oh, and of course, we've got an update that we'll get to here shortly regarding the former director of National Intelligence and his recent appearance on television discussing all the UFO information the government has been collecting. Yeah, that too. So we'll get to that shortly. First, I do want to touch on just a couple of news items here. I mentioned there in the intro, in a never-ending string of reports of potentially deadly asteroids that are always whizzing by our planet, PhysOrg reporting here that the largest asteroid to pass by Earth this year has now made its closest approach. It was already known that it wasn't going to pose a threat, by the way, but it did allow astronomers a rare chance to study a rock formed during the beginning of our solar system. So, at least so far as what they can tell us about how things looked in our solar system a long time ago, we like potentially deadly Earth impactors, especially when they don't actually collide with Earth. But as PhysOrg reports, the asteroid was 2 million kilometers, that is 1.25 million miles away, at its nearest. So no imminent threat. And that, in fact, is more than five times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. Nonetheless, that is still close enough, according to NASA, that classifies as a potentially hazardous asteroid. Now here is why and when those things can become a problem. If an asteroid is spinning in such a way, in its orbit around the Sun, that certain sides of the space object are exposed for longer periods to the warmth given off by our sun. What can happen is that ice can begin to melt, the ice that collects on the exterior of those objects. And as it melts and then begins to evaporate, it actually can produce enough of a propellant force that it can adjust the position in its orbit of said asteroid. And so when asteroids move in their orbit, NASA has to keep an eye on them and make sure that they aren't going to be potentially aligned with Earth for an impact in the near future. This one being far enough away and not appearing to move any closer to Earth with time is not considered a direct threat. But earlier this year, there was a smaller asteroid that within maybe the next century actually potentially could be a concern. And so, for my own part, I'm just really glad that NASA is calculating all of this and keeping tabs on these potentially hazardous asteroids, no matter how far away from Earth they may be at any given time. As PhysOrg reports here, NASA tracks and catalogs such objects that could potentially slam into Earth and unleash enormous destruction, like the massive asteroid hit that wiped out 75% of life on planet Earth 66 million years ago. And of course, there are also some who propose that there's evidence for a similar impact event that occurred more recently. We've talked about that in the past, the so-called Younger-Dryas impact hypothesis. Although, even those who are proponents of that idea aren't really sure that an impact occurred. But that's another aspect of all this that has to be considered. Because even if a space rock doesn't actually hit the Earth, it can burn up or explode in the atmosphere as it's on its way toward earthly soil. Yeah, that explosion can be as devastating. Think about Tunguska in 1908. Here we have what appears to be a space rock explode over remote Siberia in 1908. No impact location has been found. Some researchers think there might still be one, but there's no overt evidence of a crater left by that object. There were, however, miles and miles of flattened trees. I mean, it really did some damage and presumably never hit the Earth. So we're just as concerned about objects that may burn up or explode in the atmosphere before they ever actually make landfall. Sure, we would prefer they not smack into the Earth, but the airbursts are a concern also, and so it's important that we keep an eye on these potentially hazardous asteroids. But asteroid 2001 FO32, that astronomers recently saw whizzing past the Earth, was discovered 20 years ago, and astronomers have kept an eye on it ever since, even though traveling at about 124,000 kilometers per hour, that's 77,000 miles per hour for all you folks stateside, and we have to count everything differently over here, and I'll never understand why. But nonetheless, this space rock, dangerous though it is on account of its size, roughly the size of the Golden Gate Bridge, and at that speed, it's still too far away for us to really be concerned about. So nonetheless, we will keep an eye on it and plenty of others, and of course, those space rocks which have yet to be discovered, which might be lingering out there. You know, we had been tracking an asteroid that was making a close pass by the Earth back when the Chelyabinsk incident happened a few years ago. You remember that, the asteroid that exploded over Russia. And I actually spoke to someone at NASA who had said, you know, even though the asteroid we were watching was completely different, it's almost hard to fathom that while we're watching one potentially dangerous asteroid, another one sneaks in the back door and explodes, and actually did manage to cause some damage. I mean, it wasn't on par with Tunguska, but it was concerning enough, largely on account of the fact that while we're watching one asteroid, we didn't even see this one coming. However small it was, I mean, it was able to do some damage nonetheless. So it calls into question yet again how good our systems for tracking these space objects actually might be. Now, another thing I want to touch on here as well, we've got this story recently about various kinds of bacterial life that have been discovered on board the International Space Station. And the really interesting thing about the bacteria that was discovered, retrieved from various locations on board the ISS, is the fact that they were unrecognized, some of them, to science. Now, the way this was reported in the media, of course, a lot of people are like, what? New life forms found on the International Space Station. Okay, how did they get up there if they are unrecognized by science? And so naturally, that sort of peripheral reporting might lead some to believe we're talking about, that's right, extraterrestrial life. But let's be clear, these were varieties of bacteria that were unrecognized to science, but similar, in fact, I believe actually of the same strain as certain known varieties, which are well known here on Earth, and that actually play an important role in plant growth, generally found in soils around streams and things like this. So these were not extraterrestrial bacteria. These certainly were earthly bacteria. As far as how they got up there, well, there have been plenty of instances in recent years, actually going on for several years now, where the International Space Station astronauts have grown vegetables there on the ISS. Hey, astronauts got to eat too. And in addition to being able to provide food while they're there via growing it on the space station, the ability to grow plants in space also tells us a lot about the feasibility of longer-term space missions. And that's one of the cool things about these bacteria, because they obviously made their way up there by being carried on past deliveries of soil and vegetable matter. But the fact that we have bacteria that is able to thrive in a otherwise fairly harsh environment. I mean, keep in mind, humans can subsist just fine on the ISS for at least a reasonable amount of time. When astronauts spend a lot of time in space, of course, muscular atrophy can begin to set in. Other effects can also take place, essentially because humans are not designed, we didn't evolve to be able to live in a zero-gravity environment like that. And so even though humans can survive in a location like the ISS, it's not exactly considered the most hospitable environment for life. And so when you have life forms, plants that can be grown there, bacteria that can thrive there in various locations around the ISS, which included like a dining table, they also recovered it from a filter and some other locations, but that seems to suggest that not only are certain bacteria more resilient than we would have expected, but the fact that these aid in plant growth may actually be helpful for future space missions. And so scientists are very interested in the discovery of these bacteria and also the study of various applications in terms of how they might be useful for future long-term space missions. I tell you, it seems that with every passing day, there are new discoveries being made which are making human spaceflight to locations like Mars not only possible, but really just a matter of time. Especially if guys like Elon Musk get their way. But on the other side of this break, we have an update about what the DNI had to say recently, the former DNI, about UFOs, and what that may have to do with a forthcoming government report about that subject. We'll dive into that and more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Some surprising statements by the former director of national intelligence during a recent appearance on Fox News. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. That's right. Actually, quite a lot was being said the other night. And a bit of a surprise. I'm not sure that anyone really expected that UFOs would come up. But then again, expect the unexpected. We hear an awful lot about that subject these days, and here in a moment, after we provide this update, we're also going to talk about these NASA UFO files in advance of getting Ted Rowe on the program here with us. But here's essentially what happened during an appearance on the program of Maria Bartiromo. John Ratcliffe, former DNI, was talking with the host about a variety of different intelligence-related issues when she popped the question. Not that question. She was asking him about UFOs. And, in fact, let's head over to the audio soundbites here. I want to feature a very brief snippet from that exchange where the DNI was discussing what the government actually may be releasing in a forthcoming report from the UAP Task Force.
I want to ask you about UFOs, unidentified flying objects. The Pentagon is going to come out with a report by June 1st. And in the $2.3 trillion omnibus appropriations legislation passed in January, it includes the Intelligence Authorization Act, money for the Pentagon to continue investigating UFOs. John, we're going to get this report June 1st. Can you tell us, have unidentified flying objects been seen?
Well, sure. We have lots of reports about what we call unidentified aerial phenomenon. And this actually is a program that's been in place for a few years in terms of a task force that has been there under the National Defense Authorization Act. But as you correctly point out, Maria, there's now a report that will be issued by the Pentagon, by the Secretary of Defense, and the Director of National Intelligence. I actually wanted to get this information out and declassified before I left office, but we weren't able to get it down into an unclassified format that we could talk about quickly enough. But frankly, there are a lot more sightings than have been made public. Some of those have been declassified. When we talk about sightings, we're talking about objects that have been seen by Navy or Air Force pilots or have been picked up by satellite imagery that, frankly, engage in actions that are difficult to explain, that movements that that are hard to replicate, that we don't have the technology for, or traveling at speeds that, you know, exceed the sound barrier without a sonic boom. So, in short, things that we are observing that are difficult to explain. And so, there's actually quite a few of those, and I think that information is being gathered and will be put out in a way that the American people can see. We always, when we see these things, Maria, we always look for a plausible explanation. You know, weather can cause disturbances, visual disturbances. Sometimes we wonder whether or not our adversaries have technologies that are a little bit further down the road than we thought or that we realized. But there are instances where we don't have good explanations for some of the things that we've seen. And, when that information becomes declassified, I'll be able to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, he would have, I guess, back when he was the Director of National Intelligence. Nonetheless, of course, he seems already to know a few things, and among the things that he goes on to describe to Bartiromo during this exchange had been multi-sensory arrays, of which there was very little additional information given, but again, multi-sensor detection of what the government takes to be UAP. We also have satellite imagery, he says, and also other data that has been collected, which seems to support the existence of unidentified flying objects. And, of course, he also clarifies, we suspect, maybe at times, that there are technologies that other nations may use. I mean, to that point, we already know that China and Russia have been developing hypersonic capabilities in the last few years. And in my opinion, you know, the United States has really kind of lagged behind in terms of its own hypersonic development. The main reason being that we have perfectly good ballistic missiles, which are effective enough that hypersonics have not necessarily been a requirement. But then again, when your enemies are potentially becoming the leaders in the development of such technologies, you know, you don't want to fall behind. And the Pentagon, of course, maintains that the U.S. has historically been a leader in hypersonic technologies. So if they want to be able to stay ahead of the curve and, more importantly, ahead of our rival nations, potential enemies, yeah, we need to make sure that we know what they are producing. And so one of the reasons that UAP observed by the U.S. government in recent years has been of such concern is because we want to know what other nations might be developing. And if we see something that really seems far out there, really exotic, especially if it's operating near or within U.S. airspace, that immediately is going to be a concern if it is believed to be something that belongs to China or to Russia, right? That's nothing to be taken lightly. But if we are to read into what Ratcliffe is saying in this audio, he seems to be saying that there are some phenomena that have been observed, even taking into account possible advances by China and Russia, which cannot be easily explained here and which we don't have enough data to be able to identify. That, of course, also having been stated by the Pentagon last spring when they released officially the three Navy videos that were already out there in the wild, but which they officially released in an authorized capacity. So as to clarify to the public, yeah, you know, we collect data. Here are three videos. We class the objects in these videos as unidentified, whatever that may mean, which again, there is still some speculation about, but more on that at another time. So this was certainly an interesting exchange between Bartiromo and former DNI John Ratcliffe. We will, of course, have a link to that in the show notes, as well as some commentary on this provided by my pal Tim McMillan over there at the Debrief over the weekend. But speaking of the Debrief, some of you guys in recent days who have been keeping up with what we publish over there at the Debrief may be aware of a lengthy feature written by yours truly having to do with NASA's collection of pilot incident reports involving what appear yet again to be the very same sorts of things that Ratcliffe was describing to Bartiromo right there. UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, UFOs as they've been known more popularly over the years. And in this article, I mean, this is really, for me, kind of the current culmination. I'm sure that the research will continue and there'll be additional details forthcoming in the months and years ahead. But for me, this has actually already been years in the making because starting in around 2012 or 2013, I first became aware of the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which is an incident reporting system maintained by NASA, essentially for the FAA, which anonymously logs potential hazards by pilots. And we've talked about it plenty in the past over the years on the program because of the fact that I have been doing research and mining this database for UFO reports. And to me, one of the most mysterious things about this reporting system and the UAP data that it seems to have collected is how little people pay attention to it. That's right, I have spoken to a number of aviation professionals, journalists, you know, people over the years about this. I'll ask them, have you ever looked into the Aviation Safety Reporting System and some of the data it collects on potential pilot encounters with UAP? And many who I've spoken to don't even know what the ASRS is. So it's very mysterious to me that we have a collection system that, albeit unfrequently, nonetheless has collected some incident reports, which to me seem to depict very unusual technologies. To give you an example, back in 2015, over Greene County, New York, there was a small sailplane that was flying on a Sunday afternoon, and the pilot and his passenger, for whom it was their first time in the air, are flying along toward Windham High Peak. When they look down, something reflective catches the eye of the pilot down below them, and he looks down and he sees what appears to be an object moving over the trees below them. And it wasn't long after he notices this object that the pilot says whatever it is suddenly comes hurtling toward them. Now, he initially judged that it was about 5 miles from them. He later, during a callback with investigators for the ASRS, guessed that the distance might have been a little closer, maybe 3.5 miles, but he nonetheless says that in a matter of seconds, this object speeds toward them and is soon just off of their wing. Well, he says that there's no form of propulsion of any kind visible. He says that the object appeared to be kind of like a half dome with a almost rainbow kind of shining or glistening exterior. And it was highly reflective. He said that below that there were what appeared to be antennae that were sticking down. And that whatever this thing was became aware of them, zooms up there, takes a look, and then he says it takes off, and that his passenger watches the thing as it goes off up toward the clouds above them and is joined by two more of these, whatever they are. The pilot called them UAVs. And that's not surprising because in a lot of these pilot reports, you can tell that the pilots are very disturbed by things that they see, but they are loath to call them UFOs. They know what happens when they call them UFOs. And so in this instance, we have the pilot saying these unmanned aerial vehicles, whatever they were, you know, group together and fly off into the clouds. And he said, we made it back to the airport pronto. We wasted no time. We turned around and we got the heck back to the airport. Well, I was able to find out what the airport was. I actually contacted some of the staff at that airport, but they declined to comment on this if they even knew anything about the incident. I reached out to the director of the Aviation Safety Reporting System, who also declined to comment directly, but arranged for me to speak with the FAA. And they were able to provide some commentary, at least about the general operations of the ASRS. But in the statement that they provided to me, the FAA did not clarify what they think or what its positions are on UFOs, of course. Why would I have expected that they would? You know, as a journalist, I have to reach out to these agencies, but I did not expect for them to say, yes, we from time to time log UFO reports, and NASA diligently looks at those in the ASRS. Now, I don't want to sound too critical, because even if they don't seem to have any kind of special concern about UAP, or as the pilot in the incident from 2015 described them, UAVs, again, these are very small craft. He said, I couldn't see any propulsion system. There were no rotors, no wings. We don't know what these things were. But they obviously didn't appear to have humans in them, so he called them unmanned aerial vehicles. Vehicles capable of incredibly fast speed and maneuvering, and one capable of closing a distance with his aircraft so quickly that he initially was afraid that this thing might collide with him. He said, I was banking, and I was trying to watch the object. He said, my passenger and I got a really good look at it. We weren't able to get a photograph, he also noted, although he said that they did have a camera with them. But he said, I was too concerned about trying not to hit this thing as it flies up, buzzes us, gets off of our wing, watches us for a minute, and then takes off. And even if we were to assume, well, could have just been a drone. You know, I have shared this with a few other researchers and professionals over the years, and opinions are mixed and varied. Nobody is sure exactly what the aircraft being described might have been. And that's what I emphasize in the article that I wrote, which we'll have linked there in the show notes as well. Definitely want to check this out. It's a lengthy account, and it provides not only details about these investigations from over the years, but I also have archived versions of the actual reports from NASA that you can access and read as PDFs. But coming back to the ASRS and why I'm not inclined to be too hard on them, even though I would like to see more serious attention, analysis, and assessments, you know, being put toward UAP reports by pilots, even if the FAA and NASA do not appear to pay special attention to these, nonetheless, they are collected from time to time. And that in itself is significant because it does provide some useful data for civilian researchers who are not so hesitant to become involved in UAP research as the government agencies are. But therein lies another one of the grand mysteries about all this to me, too. Because the government, yes, perhaps does collect some information about UFOs. Yes, perhaps by June, if Ratcliffe is correct in what he says that he has seen and what this forthcoming UAP Task Force report may detail, maybe the public will get a clearer idea about what in recent years government agencies have been collecting about the UAP issue. But when I talk to professionals who have spent decades studying this, the response about the government and its involvement is almost always unanimous. You know, maybe government studies of UFOs are not going to be where the real progress will be made. Because you got to keep in mind, not only is government data often kept from the public, except for in rare instances like with this UAP task force, and even then, it is unclear, as of the present moment, how much data will actually be made publicly available. There may be data that is provided to the Senate Intelligence Committee, but which thereafter will not necessarily be deemed consumable in its entirety to the public. So we may not see the entire thing, even if some in Congress do. But the other side of this, too, is that the government is not necessarily looking for evidence of extraterrestrials. And in fact, if they ever found compelling evidence of something like that, they might not necessarily be very inclined to do much with it, unless it meets one criteria, that there is a apparent threat potential. You know, what our government does, especially our military, is they assess potential threats. When we look at past limited government studies involving this subject, the Advanced Aerospace Threat and Identification Program, yet again, the name says it all. But as we also know from what Lou Elizondo and others have said about that program, in addition to identifying potential threats, that program wasn't just looking for quote-unquote UFOs. It happened to study phenomena which falls into that category, but really what that program was looking for were any variety of potential aviation threats. Advanced aerospace threat and identification. That's what that program was aimed at. And that certainly does not necessarily only qualify for seemingly exotic technologies which the U.S. government cannot identify. And so all that to say, given the parameters within which the government operates when it comes to UAP, and given their reasons for looking at them in the first place, Many professionals I talk to, including the gentleman who will join us soon, Ted Rowe of NARCAP, they say, really, government studies of UFOs are inherently going to be limited to assessing a potential threat. And even if they find something interesting, especially something that would interest the UFO community, but they don't identify a threat, they aren't probably going to be as inclined toward further studies as we would. And so, yet again, when I speak to professionals, they often say, we should really try to enhance public awareness. We should try to get more academics and professionals involved in UAP studies. We certainly want the government to provide data that it may have collected, but we perhaps should not rely on the government to actually perform the studies. We shouldn't necessarily put too much emphasis on the government's interest in UFOs, because really advancing our knowledge on that topic may be more likely to occur in the civilian sector. And so the other thing that's really baffling to me about things like NASA's UFO files is that I write an article like this, and although it was quite a splash, I mean, it was the best performing article, at least in recent days over there at the Debrief. I'm glad it was because, you know, Tim and MJ and I and the rest of the gang there at the Debrief, we are trying to advance this dialogue a little bit. That's our aim, that's our objective when it comes to reporting on that subject, and it's not the only one that we cover. And yet, as I'm looking at the discussion in various UFO groups and things online, I'm actually surprised at how little interest there seems to be when there is UFO reporting done that doesn't have to do with some sort of sensational new details released by the government. You know, even within the UFO community, many are just enchanted by this mystique of government UFO data, and I'm not saying it's not interesting, but you know, when you've got NASA UFO documents that are detailing these harrowing encounters that pilots have had, you'd think that the UFO community would be more interested in that. Ah, yeah, but if you didn't get them via FOIA, it's not as important. And strangely, I really do think that that is an attitude that you see pretty frequently these days. Which also concerns me because if and when the forthcoming UAP Task Force report is released and it doesn't give the community everything that they have been desiring, what are they going to do then? What comes next? More fundamentally, the question I keep asking is, when will the UFO community stop placing all of their hopes when it comes to UFO research and furthering our knowledge about what UFOs might represent on government? Sure, the data the government has been collecting, if it's like what DNI Ratcliffe has described, will be of significance, but that only if it ends up being released. But at some point, civilian researchers are going to have to take up the cause, and we're going to have to try and do something with the data we have collected. And there are plenty of organizations out there that have already been collecting that kind of data and even cooperating with groups like NASA's ASRS. One of those is the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, and its director, Mr. Ted Rowe, will join us when we return here on the program for an in-depth discussion on what it has learned about UAP over the years. It is the Micah Hanks Program. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. The National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. Their website is narcap.org, that is narcap.org. And there you will find an advisory that they published for pilots, air crews, air controllers, and aviation professionals related to UAP or UFOs and aviation safety. And I want to point out that in recent years, this organization really is partly responsible for advancing the use of that terminology, UAP, in relation to the study of this phenomena. And in fact, I have followed the work of the NARCAP organization for a number of years now. And today I am delighted to have joining us Ted Rowe, an original founding member and executive director of NARCAP.org since 1999. He's currently its director of research. Now, Ted has spent the last 20 years administering for the organization and documenting and analyzing aviation safety-related cases that may involve unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAP. NARCAP has conducted studies on well-known cases like the 2006 O'Hare Airport case and published studies addressing different aspects of UAP flight dynamics, which we're going to talk about today. Ted has also published or helped to publish over 45 papers on various aspects relating to aviation and UAP. And I got to tell you, over the course of just the last few weeks talking with him on the phone, I have learned new things about the study of UAP. So without further ado, Ted Rowe, welcome to the program, sir.
Greetings, and thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. I tell you, you're a guy who has been putting in so much work for decades into this topic, and anybody who thinks they understand UAP, I would tell them right now, head on over to narcap.org right now and read those research reports. We're going to discuss a few of those with you today, but let's talk a little about NARCAP, what it is, and its history.
Well, NARCAP is the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. It was founded by Dr. Haynes and myself in 1999, specifically to address aviation safety-related incidents involving unidentified aerial phenomena, and particularly inside the United States. We have a national mandate. A lot of our original staff were either NASA or Palo Alto PhD denizens. We had Dr. Vali on staff, Dr. Heisch, Dr. Richard Haynes was our chief scientist until 2015. And we've been very busy behind the scenes trying to understand this relationship between aviation and UAP. We think it's critical to the overall understanding of UAP.
Yeah, I would agree. And Ted, in terms of how the organization got its start, had there been anything that was fundamental in really spearheading the effort to try and analyze aviation incidents involving UAP?
Well, I think the driving factor originally was Dr. Haynes' work. While he was at NASA for about 40 years, he was studying unidentifieds in parallel as a side project. And aviation safety factors kept cropping up in these incidents repeatedly. And finally, when he was facing a retirement early 2000s, when he was getting ready for that, he thought that it would be a good idea to set up a reporting system and see if we could collect pilot data relating to these safety factors. So we talked a lot about how to do that, and I helped basically lay the groundwork, paperwork, and so on to get it moving. And then we started collecting cases, more cases, and reaching out to the aviation safety community. It was very interesting, I have to say.
Oh, certainly. And at that time, there already existed some aviation reporting databases like the Aviation Safety Reporting System. It seems rather telling to me that a gentleman who had actually had some involvement with that, Dr. Haynes, and of course had worked at NASA, thought it was important enough to found a separate reporting system that would look solely at UAP. I mean, Ted, right off the bat, to me, that says a lot about maybe how much or how little government agencies actually look at the UAP issue.
Well, I would go towards the latter conclusion myself, but just because I'm not really great at chasing conspiracies.
Sure.
The Aeronautics Instruction Manual, the AIM, instructs pilots to make their reports to private UAP reporting centers, and meaning that the FAA will not take UAP data from pilots. So it doesn't really know what's going on. The paradox wasn't lost on some of the aviation safety planning community. At the time, the chief of the Aviation Safety Program Office at Ames Research Center was Mr. Brian Smith, and he was persuaded by the data to actually participate in our process and help us set up this confidential reporting system to focus on UAP reports. We ended up briefing the ASRS group when it was under Linda Connell. I should probably date all of this a little bit in case the ASRS guys are looking at each other wondering what we're talking about. But this was around 2003, 2004 when Linda Connell was the director of the program at the time. So it's been 17 years or so since we first worked with them.
Yeah. Now, for a time, am I understanding correctly also that the ASRS and some of the members who assisted with NARCAP's work would occasionally pass along information about suspected UAP incidents to your organization?
Yeah, they flagged cases for us, and we would take a look at them. Of course, the cases are de-identified. That's part of the routine that the ASRS goes through, and it's a routine that we've copied and we use in our own process once we can verify that we are dealing with pilots and everything checks out. We de-identify the case, remove all the names and companies and that kind of stuff to protect everybody involved.
Certainly.
That's what the ASRS does.
It's important, I think, to protect pilots, especially because, and again, for anyone who would think this is something specific to UAP studies, if you look at what the Aviation Safety Reporting System, which essentially analyzes reports for the FAA, but it's governed by NASA to be a third party, a disinterested party that is able to objectively look at these aviation incident reports. But if you see the way that they proceed, ladies and gents at home, they ensure anonymity in order to prevent pilots from feeling concerned about, you know, litigation or other kinds of concerns if their name is associated with what they report. So this is actually a standard in aviation. But Ted, you know, I want to talk to you for a moment too about the fact that ensuring that pilots feel that they can safely report having to do with anonymity, to me, in a lot of ways also bespeaks an issue we see with the UAP side of things. Rather than fearing litigation, I think a lot of pilots are afraid of ridicule and a culture of ridicule that has fostered them not being interested in putting their names at risk by telling people the kinds of things that they've experienced that may involve UAP.
Well, I think that's a fair assessment, but I think it's part of the problem. It's bigger than that. There's institutional bias in the aviation system. So depending on the company you're in, you're working for, you may or may not be able to deal with UAP subjects. The guy sitting in the seat next to you, you could, depending on who you're talking to, you could end up with a psych eval and lose flight status. It's more than just ridicule. It just depends on the company. We did a survey of a regional carrier, and they welcomed our survey, and it went into the mailboxes and the ready rooms, and we had a very good response rate, and we were able to look at it. We turned around, we tried the same thing at United, and were rebuffed immediately. Same thing with the O'Hare case that involved United personnel, and United was not at all forthcoming in terms of helping understand what happened at O'Hare in November of 2006. So, you know, there's a punitive side to all of this, and that's why the ASRS exists, is to get pilots to report without fear of being punished. So if there's a problem air controller or problem pilot, you know, or any of this stuff, it'll come up, and people can, the system won't lose the data. And that's why it's so paradoxical that they don't want the data when it comes to unidentified. So if a pilot can't tell you that an airplane was closing with him and tries to tell you that it was something else, then they don't want that data.
Yeah.
It's a special case situation, and they reject the reporters rather than taking that on. And this goes way back to 1953 with the CIA Robertson panel and the original Cervise instructions. We didn't have global radar at the time that could detect Russian bombers coming over the poles. So pilots were used as forward observers, and anything that they saw or reported, if they went public with it, they were subject to fine and imprisonment. In 1958, I think about 450 pilots stepped up and kind of protested that regime as well. I don't think it went well for them, but that's been the way the aviation system has kind of dealt with this. It falls under national security, and so the information doesn't move. And then on top of that, the subject is ridiculed by academics, and anybody that wants to protect their career as a elected official or something will hedge against the UAP subject as a reflex just to protect their image.
Yeah. So it's even more than a culture of ridicule. We're actually looking at a sort of a systemic issue within aviation where there are a number of issues that are working against pilots who otherwise might report what they've seen. We're talking with Ted Rowe, Director of Research with NARCAP. And when we come back after this, I want to look at one of the most high-profile cases that the organization has investigated. That, of course, the Chicago O'Hare UFO incident. In fact, NARCAP was instrumental in getting information about that out to the public. We will look at that and much more with Ted Rowe when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Our guest this hour, Ted Rowe, Director of Research for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, otherwise known as NARCAP. They have been looking into the UAP issue with relation to pilot safety and aviation hazard awareness now for several decades. We'll get back into that conversation here in just a moment. I do want to remind you, of course, if you enjoy this program and perhaps would like a little more of it on a weekly basis, it is easy to do. Just sign up for the X podcasts. Those are available over there at MicahHanks.com/podcast. And also, you'll find those in the show notes every week that we put out with every episode. And you get your own special RSS feed where you are able to get this show, the X podcasts, the monthly Enigmas specials, all that on a single RSS feed, so it all comes to one place on your smartphone or however you like to listen to podcasts. Definitely worth your time to check out. And while you're there at MicahHanks.com, don't forget to sign up for the newsletter. That's right, we are offering a newsletter where I can keep you up to date on some of the things that we are doing, some of my research, articles, videos, podcasts, the whole nine yards. Lots to keep up with. And of course, if you don't already, but you'd like to keep up with me on social media, you can find me at Micah Hanks on Twitter and also Micah Hanks Official on Facebook. All right, and with all the housekeeping out of the way, backing up again, we were talking a bit with Ted about some of the high-profile cases that he and his organization have looked at over the years, and one of those, of course, is the Chicago O'Hare incident. Ted, can we talk a little bit about NARCAP's investigation into that case and what you found?
Sure. The report came to the attention of a local news personality, John Helkovich in Chicago, on the 6th of November, I believe it was, in 2006, that a UAP had been seen hovering over the sea terminal at O'Hare. Newfork director Peter Davenport got involved and tried to get some of these people to come out and come forward. And we got on the phone and started working the case too. And eventually we got a hold of a couple of the witnesses, including Sue, the ramp controller, who was reporting ground crew observations to the control tower at the time that regarding this thing. We ended up writing a 128-page report on it. Martin Show wrote our radar section. I wrote the photograph analysis. Dr. Haynes did the overall examination. While it's not a hill to die on, it's another safety factor. The incursions into Class B restricted airspace. The most dangerous time for air for a pilot is the takeoff or landing phase. And you can't have obstacles in your way that you don't know what they're going to do. That's why the airspace around airports is referred to as controlled And if you have something flying around in there that is not controlled, you've got a hazard. And that was the gist of the problem with the O'Hare case.
I think it garnered more attention than most at that time, which might have been instrumental in terms of highlighting some of those aviation safety issues. But one of the more baffling aspects of it to me had been that, seemingly with very little, if any, investigation, and maybe you can speak to this point, Ted, but the FAA seems to have, you know, almost ruled it out of hand as a weather phenomena within days of the initial report.
Yeah, it was interesting because they picked one aspect of the description, which was the hole in the clouds, that witnesses said that the UAP left when it exited. It was a disc form, and it exited vertically and left a round hole in the clouds. And that was what the witnesses described. The FAA said that that's a common weather phenomenon that occurs, and that, you know, they didn't say whether the conditions were right to actually have that phenomenon occur over O'Hare, but it actually doesn't have much to do with what the ramp controller reported to the tower to begin with. And I think it really speaks to the FAA just not being prepared to deal with UAP reports. I don't know if it's by mandate that they don't accept the reports or whether it's just a management problem. But if you don't accept the data, then you don't have data. And then if you go around claiming there isn't data, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
If I could put it any clearer, I would, but that's kind of the position they put themselves in by not taking this on.
Yeah.
And it's worse because the facility at O'Hare was inundated with self-styled researchers and UFO believers and people calling them constantly. And if they really wanted to minimize the impact that these incidents have on their day-to-day function, they would have a protocol in place for dealing with it.
Yeah.
And I think it starts with the manual.
Right. There you go. And, you know, I wanted to mention, by the way, on that topic, I mean, with all the work that NARCAP has done over the years involving pilot reports, involving UAP, you know, one step toward helping to, you know, systematize the way that a UFO investigation, whether by the FAA or anybody else, could be carried out, I mean, would be to understand common types or reported types, you know, in terms of varieties of UAP. So maybe I could ask you about that. You know, are there common reported varieties of UAP that you think can be classified in terms of pilot observations?
Well, certainly. We have a definition for UAP, and part of that definition is an object or light whose appearances or flight dynamics is not consistent with known aerial phenomena. So I wrote a study on what those flight dynamics were to start with, and I'm working on the appearances side right now, but it's basically profiling UAP by their appearances and behaviors. And what I learned by examining I did a preliminary examination of the flight dynamics of four commonly reported types of UAP, ball of light phenomena, spheres, disks, or oblate spheroids, and cylinders. And just did an analysis of their movements, looked at the way they move, and their general descriptions. And I found that, you know, the common characteristic is, one, they don't have aerodynamic lifting bodies or use propulsive thrust. So they're not flying in the classic sense that a jet or anything else does. They don't have propulsion in that sense, or lift. So you would not, that's why I didn't leap at the American Airlines case that came out here the last week or so. The pilot described it as having wings. That's outlier data as far as we're concerned. That doesn't mean that some UAP don't have wings, but the great majority of the cases don't. So by profiling them, we have this ability to kind of push some of the data out until it screams for more attention, you know, unless there's really a reason to go back and look at it. And so what we've learned is that all of these phenomena have a common characteristic. They don't have thrust ports. They don't have, wings or lifting bodies. They all perform the same kinds of movements. They can go from a hover to an explosive acceleration to a dead stop without coasting to stop. They don't use air resistance or depend on gravity to slow them down. An airplane, when it flies, it coordinates between all the forces that it's dealing with. There's lift and thrust keeping it in the air, and there's drag and gravity pulling it backwards and to the ground. And so it flies in a little symphony of balancing all of these forces together, and UAP don't balance any of those forces.
Right. This is not flight in any traditional sense. In fact, we really could not call this, physically speaking, flight at all. These objects, what would be a term for that? I mean, the motive force seems to be, I mean, there is no actual thrust propellant. They are merely moving through the atmosphere. And according to some accounts, this may be outside the purview of this discussion, but some say they may be able to move through water just as easily. But this is not flight, right?
Yes, yes, it's not. Known aerial phenomena. There's basically three ways that things fly, you know, aerodynamic form and propulsive thrust is one of them. There's balloons and lighter than air movement is another one. And then there's ballistic movement, like flying squirrels or rocks or, you know, that kind of thing. So a bow and an arrow. And it doesn't move like any of those things. UAP, they don't have inertial considerations. There's no resistance to change in direction or velocity, if I was going to just boil it down to that. And all four of these profiles, including the balls of light, seem to operate on the same principal cause or source. So they're all related. And if I was looking at them in a description of a technology, I would say they have the same design philosophy. Mm-hmm. They exploit the same techniques of motion, and they're simple geometric forms.
It's really interesting. And those geometric forms, by the way, Ted, typically are extremely aerodynamic, but not yet again in the sense of conventional aircraft. We're looking at spheres, we're looking at ellipsoid or cylindrical objects from time to time. In fact, the four types you describe: balls of light, discs, cylinders, and spheres. So these are typically curved surfaces that are going to have a general aerodynamic capability, but they are not aerodynamic in the sense of aircraft with wings.
Even further, they don't necessarily present any of that aerodynamic form that they do have when they move. My point being is, for example, you can see a cylinder, it could be moving end on, it could be moving broadside, it can be rotating on its x-axis or on its y-axis. Same goes for the discs and the spheres too. So when we speak of aerodynamics, what we're talking about is reduced air resistance, right? And controlling air resistance, or movement of air to cause lift. And it doesn't do those things. None of them. A sphere doesn't have much lift, you know. There's Coriolis effect and that kind of stuff. But just generally, a sphere moving through air is not an aerodynamic form, you know, in that sense. It's just And you might wonder if these are technologies, whether these curved surfaces are a better way to present whatever tech they're using to the environment. Again, it's about shape that makes these things possible. My guess, they're not flying in the traditional sense. They're moving more the way planetary bodies move around each other, more, you know, in the sense that they're gravitational. They have their, my guess is that we're looking at something general, relativistic technology of some kind they're decoupling from local space time. They have their own gravitational influence and their own ability to negate local gravitational influence around them. So, as far as we know, nothing we know of in nature does that at this point, but it's a more natural form of movement than a internal combustion engine.
Very interesting. Yeah, and I want to recommend, by the way, also that people go to the website. Again, that is narcap.org, narcap.org, in the upper right-hand corner on a browser, and also it can be operated via a smartphone. There is a tab with a table of contents for the website. Go and look at the research papers, and you can read some of the reports that Ted and others have authored and co-authored over the years that often do source a lot of information from the world of physics in the broader discussion of what you have described right there. Very well said, Ted. Ted Rowe is my guest. He is the director of research at NARCAP. You can find them online at narcap.org. And when we come back after this, I want to get a little more specific with him about the characteristics observed by pilots who have encountered UAP. That and more awaits right here on the Micah Hanks Program. pilots and aviation professionals make a confidential report. That is exactly what the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena advises that you do. In their advisory for pilots, air crews, air controllers, and aviation professionals, you can find that at their website. We will have that, of course, linked in the show notes. But continuing our conversation with Director of Research Ted Rowe, who was kind enough not only to lend a quote to the article I did recently there at the debrief, but also took the time to join us here tonight, jump on the phone and discuss this enduring topic. And of course, over the years, you know, a lot of the research that they have done involves the pilot encounters and assessment of the different types, any trends that may emerge with regard to UFOs and their behaviors. Ted, you know, something else too, in terms of how you're describing these dynamics of UAP as observed by pilots. Again, this isn't all just coming out of, you know, Ted's or my head. This is based on numerous observations made by pilots over the years and reports collected by NARCAP. We also see other ideas or other trends that surface which might tell us something about the kind of technology, if that's what it is, at work here. One of those that really has stood out to me is what appears to be electromagnetic disturbance that results on board conventional aircraft that have been in close proximity to these UAP. Could we talk a bit about that?
Well, sure. I think even in the movie Close Encounters, they were talking a little bit about this idea of concurrent electromagnetic effects on avionic systems, on communications in particular, radio, UHF, VHF, and on autopilots and this kind of thing. And we have a study, Dr. Haynes put one together, examining 57 cases that reported UAP and concurrent EM effects, and all of them involved balls of light. These weren't structured objects. All 57 of these cases involved balls of light, and it's my opinion that these balls of light are plasmas that the object, whatever it is, that they're plasmas that are masking an object, and that object is generating the plasmas. Now, there's a few different ways to generate plasma. You can do it by impact, atmospheric impact, but you've got to be doing Mach 10 to break up atoms of oxygen, for example.
Right.
Another way to do it is through radio frequency and microwave. And then another way is through charged magnetic fields, this kind of thing. So if you have a device that's generating this plasma and it's close to an aircraft, the frequencies involved, if it's using RF to generate the plasma around it, may be interfering with EM systems on board the aircraft. My question would be about shielded aircraft and whether there are incidents involving shielded aircraft. And that's all military and security oriented, so we don't really have much data in that regard. But that would be where I'd want to look.
Yeah, that would be interesting to know. Absolutely. And you know, Ted, I should point out something, too. You know, with current hypersonic technologies, the likes of which, especially China and Russia, have really been developing in recent days. Now, the Pentagon, there are some indications that they may be trying to up the ante on the U.S.'s production of hypersonics. But once an aircraft is moving quickly enough, the pressure that's built up in front of it can lead to a sort of plasma sheathing that naturally occurs. However, with regard to the UAP, something that interests me is that even when the objects appear to be hovering or moving more slowly, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but some witness data seems to support that these objects, even when they are not moving at apparent hypersonic velocity, they still have a sort of plasma exterior or a sort of, you know, luminous spherical exterior in many cases, which seems to suggest that the plasma is produced in some other mechanism. Am I correct in my understanding?
Well, that's kind of my point, is that atmospheric impact is what, for example, when a meteor comes into the atmosphere, right? We see it. It has a long, thin, high, thin light when it first comes through because the atmospheric density is low, right? And then as it gets to lower in the thicker air, it gets brighter. The one that hit Chelyabinsk in Russia in 2013, it was doing 43,000 miles an hour when it hit the upper atmosphere. And like I said, you have to be doing Mach 10 to create ionization by impact of oxygen molecules. Nitrogen's got a different speed and so on. But airliners aren't sheathed in plasmas when they fly, and yet we've got cases of them being paced by objects that are sheathed in plasma, pacing the aircraft at the aircraft speed.
Right.
So the assumption is that if it's generating plasma, it's doing it in some way other than atmospheric impact, which requires a significant, substantial power supply in order to do that. The plasma balls, like ball lightning, for example, have a lifespan of 5 to 7 seconds. And the last case I worked, it involved a ball of light in an airliner. The ball of light was visible throughout the sighting, which was over 33 minutes.
Wow.
And we've had them, we have reports of them that last for hours.
That's incredible. And by the way, the case that you're saying that you investigated, was this the one from last year by chance?
Yes, it was the one over Mexico.
Let's get into some discussion about that, because I reviewed the entire document there at your website that you recommended to me. Also, the video, I know some have complained that, well, you know, the video wasn't all that great, but to me, that was a fantastic video. I want to tell you right now, Ted, I watched that every second of that video and listened to the pilots' dialogue that they provided, looking at the TCAS as they bring their smartphone back down and show what some of their instrumentation is displaying at the time. Notably, we have a bright object. I mean, everything is going through my mind, Ted. I'm thinking, could this have been light reflecting off of the aircraft and hence why it's strobing? But it obviously appears to be luminosity coming from the object, which you can see as it moves away into the clouds toward the end of the video. It's pulsing, and it's also pacing the aircraft. And I have so many questions, but chief among them, here's this object that is, you know, again, they're saying within maybe 1 to 2,000 feet, and this thing is not appearing on their radar. They don't detect this object. Now, one way that radar might be absorbed by an object is if it is coated by an exterior plasma, correct?
Correct. That's my guess. That's why the if you look at his display there, you can see the clouds around the aircraft, but you can't see the UAP. It's absorbing the ping. Plasmas are used in stealth aircraft to absorb radar signals. They have plasma actuators that they put on them in areas where there is some reflectivity to reduce it even more. So it's a known aspect of plasma that it can defeat radar detection.
Yeah, which is very interesting in regard to the broader UAP topic. But, you know, let's talk about this in-depth analysis, Ted, that you did of this incident involving UAP over Mexico. This occurred on March 19th, 2020, right? Yeah, let's talk about it.
I was contacted by the case overload group at MUFON and asked if I would consider doing an analysis on this. So I set up an independent study and just looked at the video and looked carefully at the witness statements and so on, and prepared a study that addressed safety factors that were involved and issues to be concerned about that are related to these types of incidents. When you have this close pacing, for example, at night, you can have an issue with night blindness. But even more importantly, the incident opened with the light dropping into view. It came from a vertical perspective and just dropped into view. The co-pilot saw it first, and it flared up very brightly, and they were both of the opinion that it was coming at them, and they both began to prepare for control inputs to evade it. They were at 37,000 feet and doing about 500 miles an hour, and as they were getting their hands on the yokes and starting to prepare to decide to make a turn and where they were going to go, the thing changed its course and heading to match their own, and then it paced outside of the airplane until they crossed the U.S. border, and they said it broke away just before they crossed the U.S. border and went parallel to the border out of sight from their perspective. And again, you know, it's textbook in that we've got cases just like this that go back 80 years. Our earliest, we have a catalog of aviation reports of UAP that go back to 1916, 1,300 cases in that one going to year 2000, and then we've got many more that we picked up in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So
the thing seemingly recognizing the fact that there's a border, maybe it didn't, I don't know, but the operators of this technology, if that's what this was, could we interpret that from this?
Well, they were operating in Mexican territory, if there was a bay. They were northbound from Querétaro Airport, north of Mexico City, into the United States. And the incident itself happened over Tamaulipas, near Monterrey. And it stayed with them until they got near the U.S. border, and then it broke away. It did a gradual banking turn away from them. And my problem was I wasn't sure whether it just crossed the border further down the line, you know,
right,
or whether it truly avoided the border. I didn't have enough data to really comment on that. And again, you know, you walk this line because you don't know if it's technology or not. So you have to kind of sort of walk the middle ground and describe it, you know, as neutrally as possible and still make sure that all the data points are present.
Right.
And that whatever conclusions you draw or questions you want to ask arise in the analysis.
Right. So assuming that the border played any role, there may be a bit presumptuous. The other thing, though, that's interesting to me about this, again, is the reaction from the pilots. Now, they weren't overtly concerned. They were excited, and the principal videographer using his phone to film this thing, he was extremely excited at what he was seeing. But as you point out, even though there was no apparent immediate threat being represented by the object, the pilots were clearly distracted by it because they're filming it, they're talking about it. This could represent a hazard in the sense that this is something that is distracting pilots.
Well, we consider crew distraction a part of our safety analysis. It is a hazard. The video was actually shot by the crew captain, the left-hand seater.
Oh.
And the co-pilot was the one who saw it in the right-hand seat. He did not want to be associated with the case, but he validated that what it was and how unusual it was. You'll note he's rather quiet throughout.
Yeah.
You know, just some comments, but the captain is rather animated. We've written an advisory for pilots. I put it out a year and a half ago, well before this case came around. And one of our warnings is that these things are unpredictable. They're unexpected and they're unpredictable. They can change directions instantly because they don't have inertial concerns. They don't experience resistance to changes in direction or velocity. And we have a number of examples of them tooling along merrily and suddenly taking a collision heading or a close pass, near miss. Sudden loss of separation type situations. And pilots should never get comfortable or cavalier when these things are around. They need to be on their toes and alert and paying attention. We don't know if they've knocked down aircraft or not, because the low survivability of air crews in incidents and the intermittent detectability of these UAP on radar. So we don't know if UAP have contributed, but we have claims by pilots that UAP have hit their aircraft. So we take a very conservative approach to all of this, and I tell any pilot that's listening to this that if they find themselves confronted by one of these things, to put it behind them and make a report to the ASRS.
Yes.
And to us. We'd like to hear from you. You know? But safety first. This was a transport cargo wide body. In this case we're talking about here, and so there were two people on board, and that was it. Just the pilot, the co-pilot.
Uh-huh.
But if there had been souls on board or anything like that, I would have considered that all of that behavior would be a bit cavalier.
Right.
Really need to be on the ball when these things are around.
Certainly. We are talking with Ted Rowe, Director of Research for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. Whether or not you are a pilot or aviation professional, I highly advise you check them out online at narcap.org. And we will conclude this conversation with Mr. Rowe when we return right here. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back, and what a conversation with Ted Rowe, Director of Research there at the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. Definitely someone whose voice I would like to be hearing more out there in the current dialogue pertaining to UAP. And with all of the information we may be hearing about in the weeks to come, I think it's really important to point out that there's already an awful lot of information that is already available to the public that actually may detail more information related to UAP than anything we have yet to see from government. And this is definitely something I would like to see a lot more of. People paying attention to all the data, not just whatever sensational, because someone who works in government is talking about it. I'm sure that our government intelligence agencies have some information that is of interest. And if it is released to the public, again, it will be up to the UFO research community, the scientific community, for those who are willing, daring enough to become involved, to look at that and to assess it and to try and determine if there is indeed a there, as past attempts really have failed at doing. But there have been plenty of people who for years, decades in fact, have already been applying science and the principles of investigative research toward this issue. And we need to stop only looking at what is attention-getting, eye-grabbing, the red meat, so to speak, whenever it appears on primetime television. Now, Ted, coming back to you, and again, I want to thank you for being here on the program with us tonight. Something else I want to ask you about. Ted, I recall Dr. Haynes in one of the reports featured there at the NARCAP website that UAP, based on analysis from extant reports, and this, I believe, from a report in 2000, if memory serves, but he had said that there's no apparent overt threat from the UAP, but the fact that they can be such a distraction to pilots, and that at times, and this is also significant, some cases, which I'd like you to speak to this point specifically, Ted, some cases do seem to indicate reactions from pilots that could have led to injury of crew or even passengers. Those aspects nonetheless make the appearance of UAP in controlled airspace, you know, anywhere in our skies where pilots might be able to see them, a threat. So could we talk about those secondary threats that we might associate with UAP?
Well, sure. In the first part, I somewhat differ with Dr. Haynes on his assessment that they aren't an overt threat. These things are moving really quickly, and reaction times are really limited. And like I said, we just don't have enough data because of their intermittent detectability on radar and the low survivability of aircrews. We really don't know how much of an overt threat they are, but I take a conservative stance. The issue of control inputs becoming threatening is an important subject. The overreacting or the presence of UAP causing a reaction by the aircrew could be a significant contributor to a catastrophe. If they're not in agreement in terms of what's to be done and how, and they have a limited amount of time to make a decision, or if they feel that they have to make a decision, even though the situation doesn't call for one, it's a near midair, right? It comes right at them, and they have a choice between moving or not, so they choose to move, but it wasn't actually going to hit them. But the choice to move caused problems. It's a tricky situation no matter what, and that's why I strongly advise pilots that if they're confronted by something that they can't identify, to move away from it. Yeah. Do not approach it. Don't try and communicate with it with your running lights. Try and get a radar fix on the thing. Try to get ground radar to confirm its presence if you can, and then make a report when you get on the ground. Don't just fly along next to the darn things and expect that everything's going to be fine. There's no guarantee there.
Yeah. Do you have instances where there have been pilots that you know of who have actually used ground lights or other kinds of lighting on the craft to try and communicate with the object?
Yes. I did an analysis of a ball of light phenomena for our Project Sphere, which was a compilation of about 20 papers, a study of UAP that presented spheres, and I wrote the U.S. section for that. And in one of those incidents, we had an airliner that saw UAP that was bright, but they could look at it, and so they tried to signal it with their landing lights, which are quite bright, and it flared back, and they ended up with night blindness. It literally blinded the air crew that were looking at it for a short period of time. So I don't know that whether it was responding to them or not, or, you know, how you would interpret what actually, why it happened the way it did. But yeah, so I've got one example anyway I can recall off the top of my head where that occurred.
That's interesting, though. I mean, so there is this, and actually, I remember Dr. Haynes actually writing about responses from various, you know, UAP over the years. But that's interesting to me, in part because of another aspect of this phenomena and the consistency of reports that pilots have filed over the years. Another aspect, and this actually one related to the March 19th, 2020 incident you investigated, is the object ascending, or rather descending, from a higher altitude and then not only leveling out with the aircraft that is observing the UAP, but then apparently pacing it. And you see this an awful lot. Yet again, I try not to speculate too much, but I can't help but wonder if these objects will seemingly respond to, you know, light communication, if they will pace an aircraft. I mean, they appear to be in many ways interacting with aircraft.
Well, you know, yeah, we've got reports that, and this is just talking about balls of light. We've got reports of them approaching aircraft and doing loops around them, almost playful type behaviors. We've got behavior around military aircraft that I would call intimidation.
Really?
You're fast, but we're faster. You're thinking about shooting us, and we're not there.
Huh.
This kind of thing. Again, you know, this is highly speculative. I can show you data where you can interpret it that way. Others might look at it another way. But if we're dealing with an intelligence behind all of this stuff, it does seem interactive to a point. And it doesn't seem to care. This argument about an overt presence, it doesn't seem to care about overt and covert very much. There are situations where it's clearly where there seems to be a covert aspect to it, but it doesn't seem to care whether it's seen. And in fact, pacing alongside of an airline for, you know, that's like wanting to be seen. It's like wanting to generate a report, because space, you know, airspace is big. You can be anywhere. You don't have to be there. And yet there they are. So yeah, these are all provocative questions, and you know, as data accumulates and we work a little more closely, I think that working the angle that they might be technology and making sure we explore everything that might indicate, I think is a prudent approach.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you're actually claiming that it's technical or not, if you look at it from a technical angle and make sure that it's not technical, you know, study it until it tells you it isn't, you know, I think that there's nothing wrong with that.
One more reason I am so thrilled that you and your organization and a few others out there have been doing this kind of work. And Ted's work as executive director of NARCAP can be found at narcap.org. Since 1999, he has been looking into cases like this. I hope for many more years you'll continue to do this work, Ted. And again, I want to thank you also for being my guest here.
It was my pleasure, and thank you very much. Have a great day to you and your listeners.
That we certainly will. Ted Rowe, again, Director of Research, a co-founder of the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. We will have their information linked there in the show notes, along with all the other material that we have featured on this week's edition of the program. And, you know, at times, obviously, as immersed in this subject as I am, you know, conversations like this one with Ted do also highlight some of the need that exists, in my opinion, not only for turning a critical eye toward the way that government agencies are collecting and handling data related to this phenomena, but maybe also the UFO community. You know, I think that rather than really cold, hard facts and serious, sober analysis, far too often there is this sort of almost evangelical kind of advocacy. And when people aren't really looking at the data and they are merely speculating based on what they want it to be, therein, yet again, lies some problems. And so, on the heels of this conversation with Ted, of course, we will have some additional content for ex-subscribers where we go into the specifics of a operation that NARCAP carried out a number of years ago called Project Sphere, where they were analyzing specifically luminous orbs and other kinds of similar phenomena that have been observed by pilots for years and their possible relationship to aerial plasma manifestations and similar phenomena observed in nature. But also, next week, we're going to be joined by a very special guest, Dr. David Clark from the UK, who is also, I think, a very necessary voice, who can provide a very good counterbalance, I think, to a lot of the hopeful advocacy that exists in the UFO community. It is important to get feedback from all different perspectives on this program. And although Dr. Clark is a proud skeptic, he doesn't like being called a debunker. He says we need skepticism, but that's a very different thing from debunking. And he has a recent article, Echoes and Angels, which appeared in the 14 Times, that I am very eager to discuss with him. So we will have Dr. Clark on next week to discuss that and, of course, a whole lot more. But that wraps it up for this week's installment of the program. Thanks again to Ted Rowe and NARCAP. And as always, this show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Ray Sobbs and Warren Brager. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Stephanie Mack, Jason Pentrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I remain yours truly, Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening, and as always, stay strange out there.